You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 23rd of March 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello, welcome to Midori House. We're live from Studio One at Monocle 24. I'm Christian Yeo. Coming up, blacklisted from Europe, the women closest to Syrian President Bashar al-Assad face EU-imposed travel bans. We'll be finding out what warrants such a ban and how it'll affect Assad's British wife. And as a Friday treat, I'll be trying a special tipple from China as we look at the country's luxury alcohol brands that are overtaking Gucci and Cartier in market value. We'll also be heading into the wild and discussing the art of wildlife photography. And Monocle's Section E editor Santiago Tadites in Monte Carlo, so we'll be seeing what he's been up to as well. All that plus some great music, all to come in the next hour on Midori House with me, Christian Yeo. And now with a look at the news from around the world, here's James Luckhurst.
Monocle 24 News. The European Union has placed a raft of strict sanctions on President Bashar al-Assad's mother and wife as part of an effort to force Syria to end its repression of a year-long uprising. The decision came on a day of renewed violence across Syria, with the army firing mortar rounds into the city of Homs, killing up to 11 civilians, according to opposition supporters. EU envoy Catherine Ashton gave details of the sanctions.
We've added the names of 12 more people and two more entities to the list of those subject to sanctions. That's a travel ban and assets freeze. These include four family members and many ministers, senior and high-profile figures from the regime.
The US President Barack Obama has weighed into the controversial killing in Florida of the black teenager Trayvon Martin, pledging to get to the bottom of the shooting. The 17-year-old was shot dead by a neighborhood watch volunteer, George Zimmerman, in February. Zimmerman, a white Hispanic, has said he shot the unarmed teenager in self-defense. Mr. Obama called the shooting a tragedy and urged cooperation in the investigation.
I think every parent in America should be able to understand why it is absolutely imperative that we investigate every aspect of this and that everybody pulls together, federal, state, and local, to figure out exactly how this tragedy happened.
U.S. officials have said that the soldier suspected of killing civilians in Afghanistan will be charged with 17 counts of murder. Staff Sergeant Robert Bales is accused of attacking the villagers in their homes in Kandahar province on the 11th of March. Most victims were women and children. 38-year-old Sergeant Bales was later moved to a military prison in Kansas after being transported from Afghanistan to Kuwait. If convicted, he could face the death penalty. French officials have said they have no evidence that the gunman who went on a killing spree that left seven people dead was commissioned by Al-Qaeda. The admission will fuel speculation that the man, Mohamed Mehra, was acting alone but who co-opted the Al-Qaeda brand to commit the massacre. Mehra was killed in a gunfight with police on Thursday after a 32-hour standoff. Prosecutors said he filmed himself carrying out three attacks since March the 11th, killing three Jewish schoolchildren, a rabbi and three French soldiers. The Belarusian Foreign Ministry has said it will immediately respond to a new raft of EU sanctions. EU diplomats said earlier on Friday that the countries would impose sanctions on a further 12 people in Belarus, including businessmen and their companies, to punish President Alexander Lukashenko's crackdown on civil liberties. Pope Benedict has said that communism no longer works in Cuba and that the church was ready to help the island find new ways of moving forward without trauma. Speaking on his way from Rome for a trip to Mexico and Cuba, the Pope told reporters that Marxist ideology no longer corresponded to reality. Pope Benedict offered the church's help in achieving a peaceful transition on the island, saying the process required patience but also much decisiveness. And those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
Thank you very much for that, James, and a very warm welcome to you if you're waking up in New Zealand, where in Christchurch it's 4 minutes past seven in the morning. Now, looking at the front pages landing on the breakfast tables in New Zealand, the Weekend Herald goes quite prominent on a wine scam, $1.3 million wine scam, and the conviction of Simon Mikkelsen, who traded wine and tricked several people, including a senior surgeon in the country, into paying vast sums for vintage wines. He then failed to deliver, also accused and convicted of faking some of the labels on the bottles. And the Weekend Herald reports that he was a serial con man who faked wines by doctoring the labels. He stole credit cards and took cash for wine he didn't have, sold historic chateau cases he didn't own for thousands of dollars. Also in the Herald, the government turns its back on a terror law after little progress made on a review of the Terrorism Suppression Act after 4.5 years. And just looking at the Weekend Press as well, footy's back, says the Press. After 680 days, the Crusaders will finally be back on home soil with their new $30 million sports stadium, the AMI Stadium. 18,000 spectators expected there tonight when the Crusaders play South Africa's Cheetahs. And at the bottom of the Press's front page, shock and relief at red zonings. This is the homes damaged by the Christchurch earthquake. 251 of these homes now moved from orange status to red, which means they will not be rebuilt. It's deemed financially unviable. So those are the stories on the front pages of the New Zealand Press today. It's 6 minutes past 6pm here in London. We'll be back just after the weather with Thomas Schaffernacker.
The weather, in association with Kuoni Travel.
The 23rd of March, World Meteorological Day today, and pleasant weather for it across much of Europe. This weekend, highs up to 20 degrees in France and Italy, but also in the UK and many other countries. Even in Ukraine, the mercury will rise to 15 degrees. One place where it's still winter, though, well, that's Western Russia. So the weekend city outlook, in Moscow it's still -3 and a little bit of light snow, but in Berlin 16 degrees, a mix of sun and clouds, London and Paris sunny skies and possibly up to 20 Celsius. North America, it's been so amazingly warm these past 2 weeks across the United States in the east that all the blossom is out ahead of time, way before the Cherry Blossom Festival in Brooklyn, for example, in the Botanical Gardens. Our temperatures have been hitting the high 20s, even 30, as far north as southern Canada. This weekend, though, it's cooling off in New York. Rain is expected across most of the eastern seaboard. So the weekend city outlook, in New York City around 15 with showers, Washington DC 17, a drop from 28, Chicago 15 and sunny, and in San Francisco it's cold and wet, it's only 11. How about around the globe this weekend? Sydney, not especially hot, around 22, the sun will be out though. Across the oceans in Johannesburg, sunshine and 25, and if you're in Rio, it's humid, lots of towering shower clouds here. You're likely to catch a thunderstorm around 27. And the other side of the Andes in Santiago, blue skies in 28. That's it. I'm meteorologist Thomas Schaffernacker here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Thomas. 18.08 here in London, 7.08 a.m. in Auckland. You're with Midori House. We'll be back in just a second.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 Tagat, yeah.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 is your cousin.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The Bruno Jalava.
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Welcome back. Now, the European Union has extended sanctions on the Syrian regime, imposing a travel ban on President Bashar al-Assad's wife. EU ministers have backed plans to impose an assets freeze and travel ban on Assad's wife, mother and sister, as well as nine other figures close to the president. However, Assad's wife, Asma, is British-born and therefore it's reported she'll still be allowed in the UK. EU has already had extensive sanctions in place against Syria, including a ban on arms sales and imports of Syrian oil. Well, joining me in the studio is Nadeem Shehadi, an associate fellow for the Middle East and North Africa programme at Chatham House. Nadeem, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
Firstly, what does this send in terms of a message to the regime? And also, what does it tell us in the West about the international community's stance on Assad and those closest to him?
Well, it is, in fact, what you said, it is a message. And that's all it is, because one does not expect Assad's mother to have an account in Barclays Bank on the high street. But it does send a message that the the EU is not prepared to deal anymore with the regime and with the family. And in fact, this is the essence of the mind game that's being played between Assad and the international community. Because the international community also imposes such sanctions in order to show that it's doing something. Because they can't sit around doing nothing when 70, 80 people are killed every day. But in fact, they're not doing much in that. And they are, in a way, adopting a lot of the regime's narrative making declarations that there is a civil war in Syria, that there are terrorists, that adopting the narrative that things are not things are not just a revolt, a political revolt against the regime, and so that in a way supports the regime.
Looking specifically at the decision to ban the women closest to Assad, was there a need to do that? I mean, arguably, what business would the women have had?
Out of men. That's the explanation.
Is it more to appease the public in the UK, Europe, the US, that measures are in place now? It was reported last week, very provocative headline, Assad's wife in Harrods shopping spree as thousands die. And it was all related to online sales, but the argument's still there. There's nothing stopping Assad's wife from going to the UK to do a spot of shopping, and that won't change even with this ban in place, allegedly.
Well, it may change because her Barclay card will be blocked.
But she could use fixers if she wanted to buy things from the West. There's nothing stopping her.
When the West becomes really serious about the regime, then they will move towards the ICC, the International Criminal Court. And that's a one-way move, because once you have the regime or President Assad himself indicted by the International Criminal Court or named by the International Criminal Court, then it's irreversible. And there was a statement by Secretary Clinton a couple of weeks ago, where she said that the international community is not pursuing the International Criminal Court route because there is a possibility that they may still need to engage with the regime and talk to it. Mm. So that sends a signal that the regime is still, it's still possible for the regime to rehabilitate itself. And the sanctions send the opposite signal.
And looking at what happened in Libya last year, similar travel bans put in place against Gaddafi's family and his most senior aides. And that, as you say, that went in one direction. And you say that the same could be said for this.
No, in the case of Libya, the International Criminal Court was involved. Mm. It did not reach the stage where it has jurisdiction over the Assad family, and they're now in discussions with the Libyans whether Saif al-Islam Gaddafi will be judged in Libya or by the ICC.
Russia's not said anything about this this travel ban as yet, and it's sort of kept itself out of the arguments up until now, and it's treading very carefully in terms of its stance on Syria. Do you think Russia would impose such a travel ban on Assad's family?
No, the Russians have not. In fact, the travel ban is not in place yet. There hasn't been a statement yet, officially. And what happened today was that there was a vote in Geneva at the Human Rights Commission, and It was voted by everybody except the Russians, the Chinese, and the Cubans. So the Russians are clearly still supporting the regime.
Moving forward, then, on the relationship Syria now has with the international community, it's not looking good, and it's hard to know whether or not these measures were all but in place in name already. Would any of these people have been welcome to the EU without this official statement going forward?
Yes, legally, if there is no travel ban, then they would have been able to come, but they would have been blocked through the visa process if they don't have an EU passport. That's. But I think one should not make too much out of this travel ban at this moment. What's at stake is a dialogue with the regime, where the regime is trying to portray itself as indispensable, irreplaceable, and that the world or Syria or the region beyond it is going to be so bad. It's like, I mean, President Assad said in an interview that it's going to be like 10 Afghanistans, and that it will, that sectarian violence will spill over into Iraq and Lebanon and everywhere else. All this message from the regime is to get the West to engage with it again and try and preserve it, because any alternative would look much worse. Now the narrative of the revolutionaries in Syria is that they are non-sectarian, that they are non-violent, and that they will have coexistence with all the minorities, that there won't be any sectarian violence. So you have these two narratives against each other, and the media and official statements in the West seem to support the narrative of the regime. And as long as they do that, the regime will always think that there is hope for them to be engaged again.
Nadeem, we must leave it there. Nadeem Shehadi, an Associate Fellow for the Middle East and North Africa Programme at Chatham House. Thank you for that. You're with Midori House on Monocle 24. We're back in just a second.
With a team of 25 dedicated correspondents and bureaus in Zurich, Tokyo, Hong Kong and New York, Monocle 24 keeps you fully informed on events around the world, around the clock.
For Monocle in Caracas, I'm Sarah Granger.
For Monocle in Abu Dhabi, I'm Christopher Lord.
For Monocle in New York, I'm Aisha Spears.
For Monocle in Tel Aviv.
In Sao Paulo.
In San Francisco.
In North Vancouver.
In Manama. In Paris.
In Ramallah.
For Monocle in Hong Kong, I'm Liv Levichnik.
Bangkok.
Los Angeles.
In London.
Buenos Aires.
In Bogota.
In Toronto.
In Laetitia.
Keeping an eye and an ear on the world. This is Monocle 24.
The Menu is Monocle's delectable food and drinks program with me, Markus Hippi. On the menu, you'll find out about delicious edibles and mouth-watering drinks. We traverse the globe in search of the pioneers, making a stir amongst the food connoisseurs. We hunt down the wonderful and sometimes weird tasty trends that are making a buzz in the food industry.
We've been sort of traveling and collecting stories and collecting projects. So one of the things we hope to do is to connect all these narratives across these different geographies.
Milan to Tokyo, Buenos Aires to Auckland. Each week we send our correspondents to the far-flung corners of the world. We pop into independent bakeries, butchers and wineries to find people passionate about what they make. From French cheese to Bulgarian wine, from Japanese chocolates to South African caterpillar snacks. The Menu premieres every Friday at 1900 hours GMT. Join us for a drink where everything is on the menu.
That's The Menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Krug.
Hello, welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Christian Yeo. Now, whether it's watching the birth of a polar bear, the migration patterns of penguins, or the dramatic predatory chase of a cheetah, wildlife photography still manages to amaze us mere mortals. It reminds us of the wider world around us, beyond the urban hustle and bustle. A new exhibition at London's Natural History Museum showcases the best still images of the natural world. But joining me to discuss the art of capturing breathtaking pictures in the wild is award-winning photographer Matt Moran, who was the European Wildlife Photographer of the Year in 2005. Matt, how are you, sir?
Very well, thanks.
Now, I was just being passed your book here, published book. Most people have photo albums at home, but not one quite like this. It's beautiful, and the picture on the front of a big bear with his hand, his paw covering his eye. It's so human-like, almost. Is that your favourite animal to capture? Do you have a favourite?
That's a tough one. Bears, definitely up there. Definitely up there with my favourites. They're so charismatic, great animal to photograph. As a wildlife photographer, you're always trying to capture behaviour, and there's no shortage of, you know, a wide variety of behaviour with bears.
Are they easier to capture because they move quite slowly?
They are, definitely, yeah. And where I've been spending the last 5 years of my time photographing on the west coast of Vancouver Island, they're quite used to human activity
really?
As well. So they go about their business, feeding, you know, hunting for small fish that get trapped in tidal pools along the shoreline, and they do meander quite slowly, so it's great for photography, definitely.
So where else have you been then? Big section in here, Vancouver Island. Where else has your job taken you?
I started about 12 years ago, and my first venture was East Africa, East and Southern Africa. I spent about a year travelling there, and after that I was completely hooked. And the trip was very wildlife focused. I went with a good friend of mine, and we visited famous national parks, Serengeti, Masai Mara of East Africa, and there's no better place really for you know, large concentrations of wildlife than Africa, and incredible variety of species. So yeah, after that I was hooked and travelled further to South America. Also Southeast Asia, Vietnam, Malaysia. Just generally, I've gone to places that have, you know, good national parks, well-protected areas where you have not only amazing wildlife but beautiful landscape as well. I love taking landscape pictures too.
Is there, you know, are there some parts of the world where these images are captured in a less wild circumstance? You like to think that all of these pictures are captured, you know, in the thick of forest or in the jungle, and sometimes not so. As you say, some of the creatures are quite used to human interaction, and they're, you know, well-publicised photo spots.
Yeah, that's something that I get asked quite a lot, and you know, to get really, really good pictures of animals, the animal really has to be habituated or somewhat used to human activity. Otherwise, you know, you're never going to get close, which is sort of one of the biggest goals of being a nature photographer, is getting close to the wildlife. So, you know, I as a kid, you know, I grew up reading National Geographic magazines and reading these romantic stories about how a photographer and researchers would trek for days, you know, to photograph, you know, a naive gorilla or something like that. And, you know, that's how I thought it was. That's how I thought that's how they got those great pictures. And of course, they do that. You know, National Geographic are the kind of mecca of wildlife photography, and they go to great lengths. But the sort of, you know, the real nitty gritty of it is getting to these places that are relatively easily accessible, and also that the animal just has to be used to human activity, and that way you can capture natural behaviour as well, which is something, like I said before, I'm always trying to do.
Your love for wildlife photography, how far back does it go in your life? And was there more of a passion for photography of any sort or wildlife? You mentioned you were reading National Geographic from a very young age. Do you think if you weren't a photographer, you may have been doing something else associated with wildlife?
I would guess so, yeah.
You're a wildlife man first, photographer second.
Definitely, yeah. First and foremost, being there and seeing it is my real passion, and that's what I get the real buzz from. But yeah, growing up, I was addicted to the David Attenborough documentaries. I grew up in London, was in a city, and was, you know, fascinated with wild places. And so travelling, of course, was a big part of that, getting out of the city and going to see these wild places. The photography kind of came second. I was interested in it from a technical point of view. And interestingly, I studied in London, and it was a very studio-based course, and there was no natural light in the college that I was at. So that was something I was really interested in using as well, was natural light, and something that you couldn't control. Plus, I also learned that I wasn't very good at taking pictures of people. You know, I was a bit shy. I didn't really like that kind of...
Oh, really?
Yeah, pointing a lens in someone's face. You often get that reaction. It's you have to have a completely different skill set, which I don't have. Mm. And so...
You prefer the oblivious... attitude of an animal.
Definitely.
The indifference of an animal.
Yeah, exactly.
Not video images? You mentioned you were watching the Attenborough films from a young age. Have you been tempted to move into moving footage? Have you in the past done it? And what are the differences between the two? What does still photography give that video can't?
Definitely capturing a moment. I think that's what a still image for me anyway is very, very powerful. Of course, video does capture a moment as well. Video is something that I haven't really done much at all, but will do in the future. It's definitely a trend that's changing a lot. When I look at other photographers that are working, they're doing a lot more multimedia work, especially photographers that are interested in conservation, like myself, and getting a message out there. You'll often find, in fact, you know, whenever I post things on Facebook or Twitter, the videos get a lot more attention than the still images, which is really interesting. It's a change, a trend that's changing. And also with the gear, a lot of the high-end digital cameras have a video function.
Do you think the role has now merged, essentially?
Definitely, yeah, definitely. And the quality you can get from that is incredible too.
Well, we'll look forward to seeing your video work as well, but it's lovely looking through your book there. Thank you so much for coming in, Matt Moran, the wildlife photographer there. You're with Midori House on Monocle 24. We're back in a second. Now, we're going to stay with the wildlife theme now with some music. This is The Two Bears with the song Heart of the Congos. Heart of the Congos by The Two Bears. Now, in the next half hour on Midori House, we find out how Chinese luxury liquor brands are growing in value. We'll also check in with our Section E editor, Santiago Rodriguez Taditi, and meet one of our neighbours. But first, here's James Luckhurst with the news headlines.
The European Union has placed a raft of strict sanctions on President Bashar al-Assad's mother and wife as part of an effort to force Syria to end its repression of a year-long uprising. The decision came on a day of renewed violence across Syria, with the army firing mortar rounds into the city of Homs, killing up to 11 civilians. The US President Barack Obama has weighed into the controversial killing in Florida of the black teenager Trayvon Martin, pledging to get to the bottom of the shooting. The 17-year-old was shot dead by a neighborhood watch volunteer, George Zimmerman, in February. US officials have said that the soldier suspected of killing civilians in Afghanistan will be charged with 17 counts of murder. Staff Sergeant Robert Bales is accused of attacking the villagers in their homes in Kandahar province on the 11th of March. Most victims were women and children. A French official has said that there's no evidence that the gunman who went on a killing spree that left 7 people dead was commissioned by Al-Qaeda. The admission will fuel speculation that the man, Mohamed Mera, was acting alone, but who co-opted the Al-Qaeda brand to commit the massacre. Pope Benedict has said that communism no longer works in Cuba and that the church was ready to help the island find new ways of moving forward without trauma. Speaking on his way from Rome to Mexico and Cuba, the Pope told reporters that Marxist ideology no longer corresponded to reality. And those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
Thank you, James. Now, as I said just before the news headlines, we're going to talk to our editor of the Section E of Monocle magazine, that's Santiago Taditi, and he's been living it up in Monte Carlo. Are you there, Santiago?
Here I am. How are you, Christian?
I'm very well, and you never let me down. You're always doing something marvellous to talk to us about. Tell us how you got to Monte Carlo. Even the journey was impressive by your standards.
Well, I keep inviting you, and you never come. You need to get out of the studio more often.
I would love to.
It was a very nice arrival yesterday. I landed in Nice because Monte Carlo doesn't have an airport, but it has a heliport. So I was kindly invited to come on a helicopter from Nice to Monte Carlo, and obviously the view of the coast is a beautiful one.
Absolutely. Traveling as the locals do. What have you done since you got there then?
Well, I've been busy. I've been eating a lot. I've had lunch at L'Atelier de Joël Robuchon at the Hotel Metropole. Yesterday evening, I also went to another restaurant called the Beef Bar. And this is a restaurant that serves meat from Argentina and the United States, Angus beef from Qantas, and Australian beef. So I went for the Australian beef. I went for a corps de filet, and it was very, very good. I definitely recommend it.
Impressed with the food in general there?
I think what's really impressing is the price you pay for the food. Obviously, everything is on the high end of things. It's weird because it's a city that obviously has a lot of old money, but now there's kind of like a tackiness to the city that is not doing it very is not doing any good to the city. Although the people I met yesterday are a group of young entrepreneurs who live in Paris or in Italy even, and come here and are trying to inject a doses of energy to the city.
And you've in your time there, you've sat down with a few of those behind these restaurants, the people working inside them. And what sort of feeling do you get from them in the approach that they take to justifying these prices and also attracting people there? Because standards are quite high, and I would imagine you have to be quite forward thinking in how you present things there.
Yeah, well, in terms of attracting tourists and visitors, It is the Russians and the Ukrainians and even the people from Kazakhstan that are coming a lot to Monaco these days. It's no longer the Europeans who used to come to the Côte d'Azur to spend their summers, but it's rather this new type of visitor. I had the opportunity to interview Joël Robuchon today, the chef himself, and you will soon see him in the magazine as part of our My Last Meal piece. But what he said is that he is always working with the best products from around the world. So he's not very much into the idea of buying only locally or only organic or only from directly from a certain producer, because what he's interested in is the best quality, the premium quality products, regardless of where they come from.
Ah, so are there some things on the menu that are from far-flung parts of the world that take quite some mileage to get there, you think?
Definitely. I think that adds up to the price.
Mm. And in terms of how in tune that is with the market there, do you think that's acceptable there? Or, when you look at other cities that you've eaten in and the way that restaurants are approaching the food that they serve, is that not against what you're seeing elsewhere?
Well, I 2 weeks ago I was in Berlin, and you can get great food in Berlin for ridiculously low prices. You can get a great meal for 15 euros with a starter, a main course, and a drink. But here, 15 euros is probably what a glass of wine will cost you, a bottle of water. I think the market is right to charge those prices. I'm not sure that's something I would like to pay every day for two meals. I'm sure I would end up broke very soon, and probably working behind the kitchen counter instead of ordering from it.
What's the most interesting item on the menu that's caught your eye since you got there?
Let's see. Well, yesterday I had a tartare started that had some gold shavings on it. It looked kind of pretty, a little bling, and of course gold didn't have any flavor, but it added a bit of panache to it.
Oh, just a bit. Okay, Santiago, what are your plans for this evening then and tomorrow?
This evening, well, I'm waiting for my date, and we're going to go to a restaurant called Maya Bay. Apparently it's a very good Thai restaurant. So we're going to go and grab a bite there and maybe nice. Afterwards have a drink. There are two bars that I've heard a lot about, and one is Jimmy's, and the other one is the Before. So we might check one of those out, and tomorrow I'll probably walk around the old city and maybe check out the exhibition at the Museum of Modern Art.
And will you be getting a chopper back to Nice on the way back then?
I don't know. It depends on how much I spend tonight.
We'll stay away from those gold shavings, Santiago. I'll let you get on.
Will do.
Take care, sir. Thank you so much for that. Santiago Taditi from Section E of Monocle magazine. Stay with us at Midori House. We'll be talking at Chinese alcohol brands just after this.
Monocle Films is the cinematic companion to the magazine. Our video journalists go off on location to capture on film stories from affairs to business, culture to design. This week, we focus our lens on sheep farms down under to witness the new bounce in the Australian merino wool industry.
Well, I'm fifth generation wool grower. Our property was started in 1830. We've been growing superfine, ultrafine wool for 50 years here. I've always been interested in the land and looking after the livestock, and I've always enjoyed the sheep and the wool.
You can watch this and over 250 more films via the programs menu on monocle.com.
The April issue of Monocle is something of a vote winner, as we look at the power of parliaments from Europe's High North Sami HQ to Addis Ababa's new gathering place for the African Union. We also limber up for our Olympic series as we head out on the Tigris with Iraq's rowing team. Then there's a look at doing business in Wellington and a frothy soap story from Portugal. And our editors have lots more to offer too.
In the design section, it's hammer time as we take a look at the world of design auctions. We'll also visit the young creative set, breathing new life into ancient Kyoto. And we drop in on the LA home of Dion Neutra, a perfectly preserved residence designed together with his late father, Richard Neutra.
In the edit section, we take you inside Portugal's oldest soap producers after selecting the best grapes from a winery in Mendoza. And prepare for a smooth landing with our piece on Maldivian seaplanes.
There are also recipes for a cozy dinner and recipes for business success courtesy of a Paris meets New York publisher. The April issue of Monocle is on newsstands now or available via subscription at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back. Fast approaching 18:40 here in London. Now we're going to discuss one of the most valuable luxury brands in the world. Notable not least because it's relatively unknown outside China. Demand for Moutai, a super strength liquor from southwest China, has seen prices spiral. Some brand experts place the value of Moutai at $12 billion. That's more than Gucci or Cartier. Vintage bottles sell for millions of dollars each. And the drink is the main driver of growth in China for vintage alcohol, surpassing even the US now. All this for a drink described by some as liquid razor blades. Joining me in the studio is Elspeth Chung from brand consultancy Millward Brown, who helped compile their brand's top 50 Chinese brands. Elspeth, how are you?
Very good. How about you?
I'm very well.
Good. And, right.
We're lucky to be joined by said bottle of Moutai.
Yep, I know it's fresh from Chinatown.
Fresh from Chinatown, indeed.
Yeah,
yes.
Right. Yeah.
Now, it's quite a large bottle. It's half a litre, 53% in volume. What do you know about this drink?
According to our research, because we have our database called BrandC Research Database.
Yes.
And every year, you measure the values of the top 50 most valuable brands in China. And for Moutai, actually, according to our research, is number 13,
right,
with a value of American dollars, $9.1 million.
Right.
Yeah, so it's very valuable. And just think about it, because all the brands, because it's number 13, all the brands in front of them are telecoms and banks.
So this is the only, you know, food
like
and commerce, drink one.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's number 13.
Most people in China have heard of this. They would know this and this bottle design.
It's a very historical, very national brand. It's the most recognized brand in China.
Looking at the design of it, you would never know that it's a luxury bottle. You say it's a historical design.
And how would you describe it?
Honestly, and to look harshly, upstairs it looked like drain cleaner. It looks not a good design. Plastic cap, and it's a plain white, off-white colour.
I
assumed it was porcelain when I saw the picture. Otherwise, it looks like that grey plastic that you might buy.
Right.
And that bright red label, it looks like a chemical. It would look more in place under your kitchen sink rather than in your drinks cabinet.
Right. Would you mind sharing with us how much does it cost? Do you know how much does it? How much
this bottle, I understand, cost us from Chinatown in London just now over £100.
That's right. And I also know that from the same source, for Moutai, the older the vintage, the more expensive it is. I know for one which has 30 years vintage, it costs £2,680.
It's incredible. And as we were hearing, some sell for millions. This
is
2011, so it's nothing like that.
Yep.
But still more than £100. I've been given the green light to try a bit. Would you like some?
Yeah, sure. Why not?
Let's crack this open. I can't believe it has a plastic cap. I really am amazed.
Well,
by
something
that.
Costly, yeah, worth more than
£100,
exactly, right?
Exactly. It's meant to be very strong, so we must.
Okay, sure.
It dribbles out.
Dribbles out, right.
Oh, goodness me. So have you.
Actually, it tastes very good. It will go very smooth down to your throat and it keeps your body warm. So it's like. I think the analogy.
Should hope it does.
The analogy would be like drinking vodka in Russia. Because
yes.
in China, especially in the northern part, it's very cold. So people has this habit of drinking baijiu to keep your body warm.
It struck me as that, the Chinese version of vodka.
Okay.
So let's have a try.
You know
the
what?
Smell.
You have to say something before we drink.
Oh,
this.
Yes.
Not cheers. In Chinese, we have something called ganbei.
Ganbei.
Yes.
Ganbei.
That's right.
Let's try that. Lovely.
I think so.
It's tastier than vodka. Far tastier.
It's very alcoholic too, as well. It's alcoholic contents above 50%.
Yes, it's 50% and more than 100 proof.
That's right, yeah.
No, this has a nice flavour to it, where vodka, for me, is somewhat tasteless. This has a sharp tang to it when you first sip it.
Yeah.
And then it leaves a lovely warmth, as you said.
Yeah, that's right.
Mm. Are there other rival brands that are anywhere close to this?
The close to this is another baijiu brand called Wu Liang Ye. That's also a very popular, very hot baijiu brand in China. But what makes Mao Tai the leading one is for sure, number one is its history, because it has the longest history in the history of baijiu. And number two is to do with the weather that we just said, because it makes baijiu the most preferred alcohol in China. And also number three, which is the most important, is because it's a preferred brand by the government officials to use at the national banquet.
Right, and this drink has in fact been served to President Nixon many years ago in the 70s.
Sure.
And it was quite,
there,
a lot was made of this drink at the time, wasn't it? And the quote about liquid razor blades was from the 70s, a CBS news anchor.
That's right.
Back in the 70s called it that. I don't agree at all. I was expecting this to be quite unpalatable for my Western tongue, my weak, meagre Western tongue. But in fact, I find this quite tasty.
Oh, good.
Do you think this could take off outside of China?
At the moment, I would say, because it's mainly, even though we bought this bottle from Chinatown, but it's mostly the sales is from China. Mm. It's mostly because even for the current production, you couldn't even satisfy the local demand. So I think for the near future, you will mostly to be stay in China and just to serve the Chinese population overseas. I think I will see that's the near-term trend. But going forward, as with other Chinese brands, I do see the potential of it going abroad.
As you say, it doesn't really need, the company doesn't really need to attract foreign interest. The market in China is so vast that they need never attract foreign interest, and it's more a curiosity on our part as to the phenomena that is Mao Tai. Looking at luxury brands in China, obviously a sign of growing wealth there, but
that's right.
From the design, at least, different in their approach. You would expect more pomp surrounding the presentation of such a bottle if it was the same price and it was from Britain or the US or even Russia.
Mm-hmm.
You'd see gold. There's gold on the label, but there's very little ornate
nothing
about
luxurious,
it. No.
Nothing, yeah.
Is that likely to change, or will Chinese brands remain true to the heritage?
For the bottle that we have now, it's only, I think it's not, it's not really, it's just an average vintage.
Yeah.
But for the ones with better vintage and with the premium quality, actually the packaging is much different.
I saw one
that was very different.
Glass, and it was beautiful,
exactly.
Actually. Yes.
Especially when the one that I talk about, the one that costs £2,600, that one, the packaging is so impressive. You have to go and have a look yourself.
So do you think that this will the design of this bottle will remain timeless?
Mm-hmm.
Or will the company keep it moving forward? As you said, we don't need to attract foreign interest in it. And it's markets like the UK are, the reason it's being sold in Chinatown presumably is for an expat population. There is no reason to market this worldwide.
Yeah.
But how do you think it would be marketed if Maotai approach to yourselves, yep. how would you market this to Western consumers?
I think for the core range, personally, I would think that it's good to stay as is because it's the most, as I said, it's the most recognized brands in China. And that also means that it's also to do with the taste and also the packaging. So I think for the core range, it's better to stay in line with what it has been. But if you want to bring it aboard, of course, we have to accommodate the Western taste. And that will be something that I think they have to look into in the future.
And with big players like this dominating the Chinese market, do Western brands have a look in terms of getting rums, vodkas into the Chinese market? Or will the Chinese consumers always favour their homegrown brands?
As far as I understand, I think for in the area of Baijiu, meaning white spirit, this is the dominant brand, and they're all dominated by local brands. But for wines and other, as like vodka, they will be by international foreign brands. So this is a totally different competitive landscape.
Really? It's in a separate market, as
it were? It's a separate market. Yeah, they're all dominated by local brands. But I would say there are some local wine producers like Great Wall. Yeah, they're doing quite well in China. They have experienced very impressive growth as well over the years.
Elspeth, I hope you can just stay and help me finish this bottle, dare I say.
500 millilitres, right?
Maybe not all of it. Maybe not all of it tonight. Thank you so much for coming in, Elspeth Chung from Wood Brown.
Thanks for your time too.
Thank you. Now, staying with Midori House, we're going to head to the neighbours just after this.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
Dobro pozdravljavat, Monocle 24.
Du lytter til Monocle 24.
Están escuchando Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 no chican des.
Du lyssnar på Monocle 24.
Você está escutando Monocle 24.
Sie hören Monocle 24.
Acute Monocle 24.
Kuuntelet Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
Welcome back. That Maotai has gone straight to my head. We are going to a song before we go to meet the neighbours, and this is Need You Now by Cut Copy. Need You Now by Cut Copy. I've been told by our team here that the studio is now smelling quite potent with this Maotai, and I've got quite a glow on my face now, so it really is strong stuff. Now, every week at Monocle, we like to go out and meet the neighbours. We get to know some of the thriving local businesses which surround Midori House here in Marylebone. This week, we went to Fresco, our local Moroccan restaurant. In the market for 20 years, we spoke to the owner.
My name is Said Lakhdar, the proprietor of Fresco Au Naturel. I come from Morocco, Casablanca. I was born there, and I've been in London for the last 30 years. So we're very much into London life.
Hello.
We have no.
And Fresco has been trading for the last 20 years. And we are established ourselves as natural food and juices, all made to order. We've got a very large selection of vegetable dishes, and that includes the falafel, tabbouleh, Greek salad, and lentil and wheat salad. And also we've got the specials of the day, which is today we've got the aubergine stuffed with lamb and broccoli and butternut squash also in some yogurt sauce. Very nice indeed. Thank you very much indeed. The falafel. The green one, because we add a lot of coriander and green pepper and spring onion and some of our secret spices, and that's what give it the color, the green color. The yellow one is basically just a basic one, just the broad beans and the chickpeas blended together with very basic ingredient. Ours is very colorful. It's got red and green pepper, parsley, coriander, a few other things. And it's very yummy. Oh, Malvern is such a fabulous place. I wish if I can afford to buy a property here. The community around here is very, very nice. And we deal with a lot of people from offices. And it's the shopping area in Malvern High Street is fabulous. Baker Street, we're very much spoiled for choice. It's such a wonderful place.
That was Saeed Lakhadar, the owner of Fresco. You're listening to Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Ein Monocle 24 Lagat, ja.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24, ja, ok, so.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The proper Jalava.
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Well, that's all we have time for this edition of Midori House. Today's show was produced by Marcus Hippie, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager was Andrew Carter. The Monocle Daily will be back at 2200 hours London time to start the day in Asia. That'll be with Emma Nelson and Andrew Muller. But next on Monocle 24, just after the headlines, we have The Menu with Mr. Hippie, so stay tuned for that. But from all of us at Midori House, goodbye and have a lovely weekend.